Welcome to a special edition of Oncology Today, a follow-up program to our recent live Inside the Issue webinar focused on the current and future role of CD20-CD3 bispecific antibodies in the management of non-Hodgkin lymphoma. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. Matthew Matisar from the Rutgers Cancer Institute of New Jersey and Robert Wood Johnson Medical School in New York. To begin, I asked Dr. Matisar to comment on the various bispecific constructs and how they compare to other therapies for NHL, particularly CAR T therapy.
So bispecifics, and today we're talking about bispecifics in lymphoma specifically. There's a whole other world in multiple myeloma. There's even emerging bispecifics in solid tumor malignancies. But for lymphoma, we now have bispecific antibodies that are approved for follicular lymphoma, for multiple relapsed follicular, as well as for multiple relapsed diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. And I like to think about these sort of distinctly because they really are distinct scenarios. For large cell lymphoma, we have approval of two different antibodies, one called epcoritamab, one called glofitamab. They have a lot of similarities, and these are both approved for third line and beyond patients. They work in some ways similarly to that mechanism by which CAR T works, right? These are T cell engaging treatments, but it's not changing your own T cells. You're not bioengineering anything. You're simply giving an off-the-shelf antibody that creates an immune synapse between your own healthy T cells and the CD20-positive malignant B cell. So these are CD20 and CD3 bispecific antibodies that generate this immune synapse. Both epcoritamab and glofitamab, very active in large cell lymphoma, both able to achieve very high overall response rates, very high complete response rates, good durability of response. But in distinction to CAR T, we don't yet have the ability to say that these treatments hold curative potential. And that's a big deal in distinguishing them from CAR T, where we believe, even as our data have matured, that about 1 in 3 patients treated with CAR T will be cured by that treatment. Because we think CAR T holds curative potential and bispecifics don't yet have evidence to support that, that means that for the vast majority of patients, we prioritize CAR T over bispecific, always in pursuit of cure. So in most people's practice, and for your audience, I would encourage them to think about these as potentially sequenced approaches where prioritize, get working with a CAR T center, get your patient access to CAR. And if a patient can't qualify for CAR T or is failed by CAR T, bispecific antibodies hold a very clear potential for therapeutic promise even after failure of CAR T.
Maybe a real simple question, but I imagine people think this. So why do bispecifics target CD20 and CAR T, at least currently, target CD19?
Question. CD19 has been historically the target for CAR. There are certainly other targets for emerging CARs, and there's bispecific and trispecific CARs that are coming now into clinical trials. CD20 monospecific CAR, CD19 and 20 bispecifics. This is all work that's ongoing. Why target CD20 and not CD19 with the bispecifics? Partially, I think it's just convenience that we've had the ability to generate monoclonal antibodies against CD20 for some time. And CD20 is generally well preserved even after loss of CD19. So 5 to 10% of patients failed by CAR T will lose CD19 expression. Those are patients that can still be effectively served by a CD20 targeting bispecific antibody.
Yeah, that's also a question of, do you actually need to, or is it recommended to check the target? So, for example, to look and see if CD20 is still there before you give a bispecific.
It's a good question. And while it's not in the FDA label, it doesn't demand a companion diagnostic to establish CD20 expression. I think best practice is we are always re-biopsying these patients to make sure we know what's going on. And in a patient who had complete loss of CD20, which is not a common event but can happen, I would definitely think twice about using the 20 targeted bispecific as opposed to potentially other options in such a patient.
So can you talk a little bit about the tolerability toxicity issues with bispecifics and how they compare, for example, to CAR T?
Definitely. And this is sort of the other side of that coin. We've said that, yes, CARs hold curative potential in large cell lymphoma, bispecifics, we don't yet have the ability to say so. Bispecifics clearly do have something that CAR doesn't, which is a much more favorable toxicity profile. And when you think about any T-cell engaging therapies, whether it's a CAR or a bispecific, anything in this world, we're generally focusing on three types of toxicities. The first is cytokine release, or CRS. The second is neurological toxicity, or ICANS, immune effector cell-associated neurological syndrome. And then the third is myelosuppression and infection. When you compare a bispecific to CAR-T for CRS, there's no doubt that bispecifics generate less frequent CRS and less severe CRS. In large cell lymphoma, where CRS rates are a little bit higher than they are in follicular lymphoma, when using bispecifics, even there, rates of grade 3 or greater, this is CRS that lands you in an ICU, are very low. In follicular lymphoma, it's even better. And grades 2 or greater, grade 2 lands you in the hospital, are low enough in using mosunetuzumab, the one bispecific approved for follicular lymphoma, that it is now a fully outpatient treatment. There's no admission for observation, monitoring, preemptive treatment of cytokine release. It's just outpatient treatment with good patient instructions. Neurological toxicity is almost non-existent from bispecifics, and we don't really understand why that is. You're still creating a T-cell immune synapse. Why? What's so different about it with a bispecific as opposed to CAR? But the observation is clear and consistent across studies that neurological toxicities with these drugs are very uncommon, and when they occur, very low-grade and reversible. Myelosuppression is still a real deal. Certainly, you will have complete B-cell lymphodepletion. You will frequently see myelosuppression with low counts. Hypogammaglobulin anemia, which can be persistent, is certainly seen. So we will often end up needing to support patients either with growth factor in the context of neutropenia or even intravenous immunoglobulin in the setting of hypogam with recurrent infections. The infectious complications are certainly something that you have to take seriously and be watchful for as an oncologist for your patients receiving such treatments.
Can you talk a little bit more about that and also how you think through the issue of prophylactic antibiotics, how you compare that to the way you think through CAR-T? I kind of am getting the impression that with bispecifics, infection is maybe more of a problem than I thought it was. I've heard more about COVID. I can't quite get a feel for it, but it sounds like it's maybe a serious problem.
I would say it's not as bad as CAR. The myelosuppression is not as deep and not as profound, certainly not as prolonged. CAR patients will give prophylactic IVIG even without recurring infections because they get into trouble pretty quickly. That's not been our practice with bispecific antibodies. In terms of antibiotic prophylaxis, I'm not very aggressive with the bispecific patients. We will always prophylax against VZV reactivation with acyclovir or the like. But I'm not routinely using PJP prophy. I'm not routinely using antifungals. I will use growth factor, as I've said, if I'm treating through neutropenia. But I don't hold the drugs for neutropenia. I simply give preemptive growth factor and continue treatment.
What about management of CRS in patients getting bispecifics? I think actually on our webinar, I was telling you about Loretta Nassifal was presenting a case of a patient on mosunetuzumab. And she was like talking to the patient at when the patient was home and told the patient to take steroids, et cetera. How do you decide between that kind of approach as opposed to tocilizumab, for example?
It's a great question. It's something that we as a field are still kind of chewing on. What I would say is that for bispecifics to be successful, we need to get broader deployment across the nation. It can't just be siloed in academic centers like Loretta's and mine. And we need to be able to be practical in our support of our patients receiving these treatments. To that end, what I'm doing now for most patients that I'm treating outpatient is I'm doing something that sounds like what Loretta's talking about, which is giving patients steroids to take home with them and say, if you have a fever and you're otherwise doing okay, take preemptive steroids, call me in the morning. If it happens again, a second dose of steroids. If it happens a third time, come on in and we'll observe you or admit you. But that grade 1 cytokine release, fever without hypotension, tachycardia, any other signs or symptoms, shortness of breath, hypoxia, nothing else, preemptive steroids are very effective, and you can avoid the costs and struggles of having to get a patient back into the hospital, put them into observation, put them in the hospital, give them expensive tocilizumab. I think steroids are going to be increasingly used in a preemptive strategy as we gain more comfort and confidence with that approach.
And you mentioned the idea of community-based general oncologists giving bispecifics, and they're very interested in doing it for sure. But one of the things I wonder about, I'm not sure how many offices like that carry tocilizumab and how much of a hassle it is to get it. Do you see that as a potential? What do you think in general about the idea of this being done in the community? I hear people talking about starting in a tertiary center, then picking it up in the community. And again, how much do you need to have tocilizumab available?
These are exactly the right questions that we need to be asking as a field. I think that we're going to see an evolution over these next months and years. Phase one was restricted only to academic centers that have confidence and experience with CAR. We're now in phase two, where we're doing at Rutgers and many sites like us what you've suggested, where patients will go through their step-up dosing. This is the time at which cytokine release occurs. If they need to be admitted for observation, that's what it's going to happen, and get them induced, so to speak, and over the hump. Once you're past cycle two, day one, cytokine release is a vanishingly rare phenomenon with the bispecific antibodies and lymphoma. So after that point, to allow a patient to continue their treatment closer to home under the care of their primary oncologist, with whom they have a long-standing relationship usually, is safe, it's patient-friendly, and it's totally appropriate. And that's what we're doing in our system, is we're allowing patients after they're induced to go back to one of the sites closer to home and working in collaboration with a local primary oncologist to do shared care. It's safe. It's very reasonable. For us to get to the third phase of doing it all in the community, we're going to have to be able to get to where you're talking about, which is getting comfort and confidence and education of the local primary oncologists, being able to make sure that they do have access to things like tocilizumab just in case. There's a lot of education and logistics that are going to have to be put around that.
I remember sharing in the webinar, I remember when venetoclax HMA came out for AML, and, you know, general oncologists hadn't been treating it, and then all of a sudden they were like, are we really going to be doing this? And now they kind of totally used to it. So hopefully that'll be what happens here. I'd like to sort of dig a little bit more into the specifics in terms of benefits and risk and differences between the available products. Can you talk a little bit about, I guess, we're hearing a lot about four main products. You mentioned three of them being approved. Can you kind of, first of all, talk about sort of what are the components of a bispecific and how they differ at least between the four common agents that we've been talking about?
Yeah, so I guess the fourth that you would have in mind might be odronextamab.
Odronextamab.
Which is not yet FDA approved, but we hope to see approval perhaps, you know, within the next 6 to 12 months. So we have these three going on four agents, which have more in common than they do distinguishing them in terms of mechanism of action, targets, but there are key differences among them that do differentiate to a degree. One comparison that's very relevant in the present state is comparing glofitamab and epcoritamab. These are two CD20, CD3 bispecifics, both of which are approved for the same patient population, third line and beyond diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. So how do you pick between those two? You look at the differences between them. In terms of activity, I would say that they are comparable. In terms of toxicity, I would say they are comparable. Where they differ some is in terms of schedule and logistics. Glofitamab is given intravenously. Cycle 1, day 1, you actually pre-dose patients with a dose of obinutuzumab. And cycle 1, day 8, you give a low dose of the bispecific. Cycle 1, day 15, you give a medium dose of the bispecific. And then the next week, you give the full dose of the bispecific. And then that's continued every 3 weeks as an intravenous dose for time-limited therapy. If after a measure of treatment, patients are in a complete response, treatment is discontinued. If they're enjoying clinical response but not yet in a CR, treatment is continued a little longer, but it is still finite therapy. And that's how it's done in the studies, and that's how it's done in the real world. So here you have pros, finite therapy, cons, intravenous treatment, and requires obinutuzumab pre-dosing. If you have an intolerance to obinutuzumab, that's going to be tricky. If you have really poor intravenous access or you live at a great distance and you can't sit in a chair, that's going to be challenging. Epcoritamab has a tougher schedule. It starts out weekly for the first 8 weeks. then goes to every 2 weeks, and eventually goes to every month in the maintenance fashion, given subcutaneously, advantage. But as it was studied, it's given continuously until progression or intolerance. So indefinite therapy with epcoritamab, in my mind, is a minus. So you weigh on an individual patient-by-patient these different factors. What's more important, route of administration, duration of administration? Is pretreatment a problem or not a problem? Is the schedule a problem or not a problem? And you work with your patient to figure out which of these factors is the most important for their quality of life, their travel and social support, and you come up with a plan that makes the most sense, understanding that they're both very active, and we certainly have no head-to-head data to suggest one is better than the other.
Can you comment a little bit on the difference between a bispecific and a BiTE?
Yeah, some of this terminology gets a little bit wonky, right? People say BiTEs or bispecifics or TCEs, T-cell engagers, or TDBs, T-cell dependent bispecifics. BiTE is a historical term that really is meant to be used for a non-fully IgG-constructed compound. So blinatumomab, which is still used, of course, in BALL, is a BiTE. It's not a full construct immunoglobulin, whereas bispecific antibodies are IgG constructs, with the exception of IgM2323, which I think now has a name, Evotamab, or I believe is its generic name. That's an IgM construct bispecific, but most of these are IgG constructs. But it's that construct that differentiates what we call a bispecific antibody versus the pre-existing BiTEs.
So before we kind of explore more in terms of efficacy, can you kind of talk a little bit more about the other two agents, mosunetuzumab and odronextamab, in terms of, again, how it's delivered and, you know, globally, what the difference is between those two and the first two you mentioned?
Definitely. So mosunetuzumab, in distinction to Glofit and Epcor, is the agent that's FDA approved in the treatment of multiple relapsed follicular lymphoma. And it was initially developed as an intravenous medicine with a schedule similar in some ways to that of Glofit, where it's weekly step-up dosing, 1 milligram cycle one day one, 2 milligram cycle one day eight, and then up to 60 cycle one day 15, and then down to 30 milligrams intravenously every 3 weeks for 8 cycles if they achieve a CR, 17 cycles if they're enjoying clinical response but not yet in a CR. There's no obinutuzumab pre-dosing with mosunetuzumab. It actually ends up being competitive binding. It would interfere. And rates of cytokine release are low enough with mosun that the abrogation of CRS with obinutuzumab wasn't all that necessary anyways. I say it's been studied that way because we've also done work with mosunetuzumab subcutaneously. And it looks, to my interpretation, like the sub-Q formulation maybe at least as effective and even better tolerated with even lower rates of CRS. And many of the ongoing studies of mosun in both FL and other disease states are using the sub-Q formulation going forward. Mosun has very low rates of cytokine release, as I said, largely limited to grade 1 with a little bit of grade 2. And in follicular lymphoma, very effective with an overall response rate of about 80%, complete response rate about 60%, and median durations of response and complete response north of 2 years.
So what's the rationale for using the obinutuzumab?
So initial studies looking at glofitamab monotherapy as a treatment were plagued by what I would describe as unacceptably high rates of cytokine release. So we attempted a number of different interventions to try to abrogate or mitigate cytokine release. And it turned out that that single pre-dose with obinutuzumab did a wonderful job at lowering the frequency and severity of cytokine release. So it's really a CRS prevention strategy.
So what do you think the mechanism is of what's happening? You think a direct anti-tumor effect, or what do you think is going on?
No, I think it's probably more soaking up a little bit of peripheral CD20, which just may make initial binding a little bit less exuberant.
Huh, well, that's interesting. So maybe we can drill down a little bit more in terms of efficacy, comparing the four agents, which of course is a challenge since they haven't been directly compared. But can you kind of provide your global view of efficacy, not only response rate, but particularly duration of response, the amount of follow-up we have at this point, and the difference in terms of efficacy, for example, follicular versus diffuse large B-cell?
Definitely. So in follicular lymphoma, if you look at Mosun as compared to Epcor monotherapy, Glofit, and odronextamab, I would say that they're roughly comparable. I generally think of mosunetuzumab as a little bit of the sort of the gentlest, but also the weakest of the four. Again, this is trying to read cross-trial comparisons. It's a little bit of a fraught exercise, as you know, but that's my sense, is that it's a little bit gentler and a little bit less active. Odronextamab, of course, is not yet approved. Its schedule has been challenging with this two consecutive day step-up dosing format in an attempt to abrogate its cytokine release. It appears to be definitely active in both indolent and aggressive B-cell lymphomas, probably comparable to that which we see with Glofit and Epcor. Glofitamab and epcoritamab in follicular lymphoma, we don't yet have as extensive data, particularly for Glofit, but certainly at least as active as mosunetuzumab, perhaps a little bit more cytokine release with Epcor and Glofit as compared to Mosun. So a little bit more active, a little bit more toxic. In my mind, in disease like follicular lymphoma, where even Mosun, sort of our gentlest of the antibodies, has such good activity, that's a very clear value proposition for me to prefer Mosun over perhaps the more potent but also more toxic of the bispecifics. That's in distinction to large cell lymphoma, where activity of mosunetuzumab is pretty clearly a little bit down from that which we see with Glofit and Epcor. Mosun clearly does have single agent activity, an overall response rate of about 40% and a complete response rate of about 20%. But that's, I think, even allowing for cross-trial differences, worse than we see with Glofit and Epcor, which are more like an overall response of 60 and a CR of 40. However, mosunetuzumab, because of its favorable toxicity profile, is very combinable. And we are now doing a lot of that work looking at Mosun plus X or plus X plus Y in aggressive B-cell lymphomas, trying to leverage that favorable toxicity profile and then combining with other active agents. So we're doing Mosun plus polatuzumab vedotin, or Mosun plus tafasitamab and lenalidomide, or Mosun plus chemo. All of this combination work is being done to try to take advantage of that activity tolerability balance to see if it's perhaps the most combinable of these agents.
Bispecific plus chemo sounds a little challenging slash interesting in terms of cytopenias and infections. What do we know about that at this point?
Preliminary data are very promising. We've done prelim work combining it with CHOP or mini-CHOP in the first-line setting. There's ongoing work looking at it in combination with GemOx in the relapse refractory setting. We already have data that have been reported out for the Mosun Pola combination showing tolerability. And interestingly, actually, remarkably low rates of CRS, lower than you'd expect with Mosun monotherapy. Maybe somehow the anti-tumor activity of the Pola as a pre-dose to the Mosun is doing something to further abrogate CRS. You know, the combinations, I think, are actually going to hold a lot of promise and potential. I'm excited to see these data read out.
One of the important clinical questions here is eligibility to receive a therapy. And of course, that's a huge issue with CAR-T. Can you kind of put, let's say, your vision of eligibility for CAR-T in terms of age, performance status, also cardiovascular status? We just did a symposium on diffuse large B-cell at the SOHO meeting, mm-hmm. and we presented a bunch of cases from docs in practice, and we had a bunch of people with all older people, all kinds of cardiovascular problems. So when you look at that, sort of how do you think through eligibility CAR-T, eligibility for bispecifics, and then as opposed to eligibility for, you know, something like len or tafasitamab?
So I sort of have in my mind always this, like the archery target with the different rings, right? Or you could say interlocking Venn diagrams if you're more mathematical. In the center, the strictest would be axicabtagene-cytolysyl or axi-cel. This is the CAR-T that's associated with the highest rates of severe cytokine release and neurotox. You have to be able to really be sure that you can tolerate grade 3 cytokine release, which means you can tolerate sepsis functionally. And you have to be able to tolerate grade 3 neurological toxicity. Outside of that, you have lysicabtagene or lysi-cel, lower rates of CRS, less likely to experience grade 3 plus, but you're still not going to be comfortable taking somebody into lysi-cel with class 3 heart failure. the outside ring of that, then you go into the bispecifics where you will tolerate a little bit of a lower ejection fraction because there will be lower rates of severe cytokine release. And most of the time, you're not going to see anything beyond grade two. As long as a patient can tolerate aggressive hydration, or even at its worst, maybe low-dose pressors to get them through a day or two of trouble, if you can do that, then you can do bispecifics, certainly with Glofit and Epcor. Outside of that would be Mosin. You really see very little grade two and almost no grade three. So class one heart failure, probably fine to do mosunetuzumab. If you're so frail that you can't even imagine doing that, then you're into the realm of trying to do whatever you can to manage the disease and focusing not on activity, but on toxicity. And follicular lymphoma, that might be tazemetostat, and large cell lymphoma. I'm not even sure what it would be. Maybe tafalen if you think a patient can tolerate some low-dose lenalidomide. But in such frail patients, treatment is obviously very challenging.
Can you talk a little bit about how bispecifics and CAR-T, for that matter, fit into transformed disease, transformed CLL or transformed FL, what we know about that at this point?
So transformed follicular lymphoma is easier to tackle. We have pretty good confidence that using bispecific antibodies in aggressive B-cell lymphomas is a path forward. And we clearly see activity in that disease state. I choose that one first because it's a less complicated scenario. There's no circulating disease. It's relatively straightforward. We have activity in FL. We have activity in GCB large cell. There's no reason to be shy about it. Transformed CLL, when CLL transforms to diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, formerly known as Richter syndrome, that's a little bit more fraught. And we do now have some emerging data looking at bispecifics in patients with CLL transformation. But these patients, particularly when there remains an ongoing circulating burden of disease, are believed to be at significantly higher risk for frequency and severity of cytokine release. And these are patients that likely would need to be treated if they were to be treated in an inpatient setting with careful observation and careful counseling of the patient regarding potential risks of such an approach.
What about efficacy in transformed disease of bispecifics compared to CAR-T?
I think if we approach a transformed follicular lymphoma patient in our mind as aggressive B-cell lymphoma, particularly if it's multiple relapse, I'm not talking about de novo transformation where those outcomes are identical essentially to a de novo diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, but for multiple relapse and transformed follicular lymphoma, if you approach that patient as aggressive disease and thus prioritizing CAR-T given its durability and potential of cure, at least of the transformed component of disease. We don't yet believe that CAR-T is an established cure of low-grade follicular lymphoma, but clearly active in that disease as well. I would still say that such patients would be prioritized for CAR-T in my practice, reserving bispecifics for if patients were either ineligible or unwilling to receive such treatment or had received it already and been failed by it.
So can you comment a little bit on globally what you see in terms of partial and complete response with bispecifics, both with follicular and diffuse large B-cell, and particularly the duration of response, and whether at this point there's any evidence of a plateau?
Really important questions. Follicular lymphoma, these agents are all more active than in large cell lymphoma. FL is generally more responsive disease. That makes good sense. And I would estimate that most of these agents will probably get us something like an overall response rate of around 80% and a complete response rate of around 60% with monotherapy. Could that be improved upon with combinations? Very possibly. And we've seen some early readout of the epcoritamab plus lenalidomide combination with response rates even better than those. In large cell lymphoma, multiple relapse large cell lymphoma is a less responsive disease. Response rates and complete response rates are lower. It's probably more on the order of an overall response rate of 50 to 60% and a complete response rate of 30 to 40%. Durability, of course, is the most important question, particularly in large cell lymphoma. And the short answer is we don't yet have mature enough data to know if there's going to be a plateau. There's no clear plateau yet, but the data is still very much maturing. Is it possible that we're going to get to a place where we see some sort of plateau around the 20% mark, like we see even with treatments like polatuzumab in the relapse setting? That's kind of my guess where we're going to see the data go as they mature, but it's very much still guesswork. And I look forward to seeing how these data mature along with everyone else. In follicular lymphoma, the curves are a lot shallower, and we're seeing very nice retention of response with duration of response and duration of complete response already better than 2 years with mosunetuzumab monotherapy in multi-relapse patients. Will there be durability? Will the patients that go 5 years plus out without retreatment? Possibly. I think equally interesting is the question of retreatment. So patients with mosunetuzumab, remember, are receiving finite therapy, no more than a year. And then they're retaining that response for a measure of time afterwards. GO297A1, the trial that's led to mosunetuzumab's approval, has built into it the option for a retreatment at progression if patients come off for reasons other than progressive disease. And we're going to see some of those cases begin to be reported at future congresses. And I look forward to seeing the results that we achieve with retreatment. You can certainly imagine a situation where you intermittently dose patients with courses of mosun, allowing for more durable disease control with such a strategy. And certainly that would be preferred over a strategy of continuous treatment, such as that used with Epcor or other agents.
Do you think that, you know, sort of biologically, like which route makes more sense, you know, the short, you know, time-limited therapy or indefinite therapy? I would assume this is kind of like a function of how the trials get done, that all of them would, you know, maybe fall in the same sort of paradigm. But I am curious what your thoughts are. Do you see this evolving more towards a time-limited therapy for all of these, or you think it's going to stay the way it is in terms of how they were initially developed?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And this, you know, how these drugs were developed in the initial designs ends up impacting how the approvals look and how they're used in practice. The field has clearly moved on, and we in the lymphoma community really prefer intermittent therapy and time-limited therapy over continuous therapy. And we prefer that because our patients prefer that. There's certainly biological rationale for wanting to pursue intermittent treatment as well. You could imagine that constantly trying to engage the T cells in this way ad nauseum could somehow promote fatigue, whereas perhaps you may return to a more active T cell state by allowing recovery in between courses of or cycles of treatment. It's all hypothetical at this point. We're waiting for the science to inform us of these sort of hypotheses, but sort of makes sense.
So let's talk a little bit about the issue of where bispecifics fit in, again, particularly within FL and diffuse large B cell. And, you know, maybe if I can ask it this way, if you could sort of wave a magic wand and you could give patients whatever you want, and you have a patient who wants to be, you know, proactive as possible, want, you know, the best therapy that looks to you, in both a younger, and there are also older people with comorbidities who want to be very aggressive too. So in those two scenarios, right now, if you could, how would you use bispecifics in FL and diffuse large B-cell? When would you introduce them? Do you feel excited enough to even, at this point, would you use a combination if you could?
So I'm extremely optimistic about the class of agents. I'll just be candid with you. And we're writing and leading the studies to try to figure out how best to leverage these compounds. Mosunetuzumab is very active and very well tolerated. If I was given the choice between getting mosun and getting chemo, we both know I would choose mosun. Do I know that it's the right thing to do in the first line setting? Not yet. We need the data, but we're generating those data. And we're opening a study of, which I think is rather elegant, where patients with newly diagnosed follicular lymphoma and need a first line therapy will start mosunetuzumab monotherapy. And if they achieve a CR, great, they're done. If they're responding but not yet achieving complete response, we can augment that treatment with the addition of lenalidomide. And there's some interesting data to suggest that the immunomodulatory properties of lenalidomide may augment the activity of bispecific antibodies like mosun. So this sort of response-adapted and tailored approach of an augmented or augmentable first-line strategy may get us where we want to be, which is getting rid of chemotherapy as our first approach for the majority of patients with follicular lymphoma. In large cell lymphoma, I again am optimistic about incorporating bispecifics into first-line therapy. The goal always for me in large cell lymphoma is to avoid relapse. I'd rather treat patients once and never again, thank you very much, and I think most of my patients would agree with that assessment. So if we can incorporate bispecifics to augment complete response rate and cure, most importantly, with patients with newly diagnosed large cell lymphoma, that would be a win. those studies are all being led. There's studies being looked at with odronextamab in the first-line setting, with mosun, with glofit, with Epcor. Each of these compounds is pursuing this strategy, and I expect that to be one that has the ability to change the field.
So you verbalized your thoughts about follicular in first-line, but what about diffuse large B-cell now with the data that we have? Ideally, when would you bring it in?
Right now, with the data that we have, it's stuck in third line for me. I don't have data to support it as my first line treatment. In the second line setting, for the majority of patients, I'm pursuing CAR right now. And we know that CAR T-cell therapy is approved in patients with early relapsing or primary refractory large cell lymphoma if they're transplant eligible, and second line therapy for transplant ineligible patients regardless of time to relapse, specifically liso-cel. And as I've said, CAR T holds curative potential. I can't say the same thing about bispecifics. So in my mind, although bispecifics are active and well-tolerated, they're reserved for the majority of patients right now for me, for either patients that have been failed by CAR T or aren't qualified or able to access CAR T.
So I'm still kind of trying to run through my mind your thoughts about first-line bispecifics and follicular lymphoma. Any rationale to consider a bispecific plus anti-CD20 antibody? I mean, you mentioned obinutuzumab just as, you know, for a one-shot deal, but any reason to think that therapeutically you'd do better if you added CD20?
So my thoughts are a little bit different on it, and there's a study that I'm working on opening, which is a combination of mosunetuzumab with the CD19 antibody tafasitamab in combination with lenalidomide. We know that mosun and rituximab, obinutuzumab, they have competitive binding, so I'm trying to leave CD20 open for the mosun. So combining it with a naked CD19 antibody, which is otherwise going unmolested in the treatment programs, and we know that tafasitamab plus lenalidomide is a very active combination in patients with relapsed large cell lymphoma. Some early data suggests that it's active as well in follicular lymphoma, which shouldn't be surprising given lenalidomide's activity in that disease as well. So the mosun plus tafalen program, in my mind, is a little bit of the best of both worlds.
So I'm curious, I know you're unusual or a researcher to have so much interest in cost effectiveness, something that we don't talk about too much in CME. We kind of like focus on, like I was saying, theoretically what's best, but obviously these are important issues. I don't know what your thoughts were about the report that just came out in the New York Times that Medicare spending is flattening out, and there's a why that is. I thought that was like shocking when I saw that. Any thoughts about that in terms of what's going on right now in terms of cost containment, at least in the United States? And, you know, I was very surprised, as mentioned before we get started, I saw your paper on cost effectiveness with Polarix, which your paper, I kind of surprised that it was positive given the cost of polatuzumab. So any thoughts about cost effectiveness of bispecifics and, you know, maybe different than what we expect?
It's an important question. We actually have work that is coming out. I'm always a little bit behind on whether my data are embargoed or not. But I'll suggest that when you're looking at cost effectiveness of anything, and particularly when you're doing budget impact modeling work, you have to think about how much it costs and what you get for your money. And you have to juxtapose that against your competitors. So you have a course of a drug like mosunetuzumab in follicular lymphoma. You're going to pay a fixed cost. It's fixed duration treatment. And you get a lot of bang out of that buck in terms of response rates, low rates of toxicity. So you juxtapose that to something like chemoimmunotherapy, which is not cheap and has additional costs of toxicity associated with it. Or you compare it to CAR T, which is very active as well, but wickedly expensive and also carries toxicity costs. I would suggest that you might not be surprised if you were to see results that suggest that mosunetuzumab would be cost-effective in this context in comparison to chemoimmunotherapy or to CAR T-cell therapy.
Any thoughts about what's going on with Medicare?
It is very interesting, right? All we see in our practices and all our patients see in their bills is rising costs. And every treatment that comes out carries a hefty price tag with it. And all we hear about is the need to work with policymakers on trying to constrain cost and to reduce patient burden of care. To see a report that spending is flattening out just is a little bit puzzling. I haven't yet seen any good cogent analysis as to what might be driving that change. Is this just a blip that is somehow an aftershock of COVID, or does it really represent some fundamental changes in prescribing and practice patterns? It's not clear to me.
Yeah, no, it's really interesting. You wonder whether or not some of the strategies that they've tried to implement, you know, the EOM and et cetera, in some way. I don't feel like it's affecting people's practices, though, that much. Do you? Do you?
I don't. I mean, we all complain about all these needs to go through peer-to-peers and all the headaches that are put in to attempt to change prescribers' practice patterns or our decision-making. But most doctors view those as annoyances and not factors that drive change in behavior. So, it doesn't make a lot of sense, and it'll be interesting to see as those data get parsed out by healthcare economists if we can really learn any important lessons from them.
I think the article mentioned the possibility of, generics and particularly biologics being an issue. Any thought about that?
It's possible. There certainly are cost savings that can occur at the system level as we move to generics. They're generally quite modest, but certainly generics are influencing spending. In my world, if you look at generic formulations of pegfilgrastim, generic formulations of monoclonal antibodies, these are all certainly influencing system level spending, but it's hard for me to believe that that's enough to really bend the needle at the CMS level.
Yeah, it seems like it. So final question, I'm curious about your vision for the future, particularly as it relates to bispecifics and CAR-T, as it relates to non-Hodgkin lymphoma, in terms of new strategies coming along that you're excited about. I don't know how relevant it would be to lymphomas, but we're seeing, vaccines, RNA vaccines. Anything in particular has got you excited?
I mean, sticking on the bispecific theme for today, I'm extremely optimistic about the ability of these drugs to be incorporated into multiple paradigms. I think in indolent lymphomas, we're going to see them move into earlier lines of therapy, either as monotherapy or in combination strategies. We're going to see them tested and deployed in other histologic subtypes, mantle cell lymphoma, marginal zone lymphoma. In aggressive lymphoma, I expect them to actually move into earlier lines of therapy. CAR-T remains a gold standard, but let's be honest, it's really the vast minority of patients who are eligible for CAR-T that ever receive it because of geographical barriers, logistical barriers, economic barriers, all of these barriers that limit access. If we can get most of the way there with bispecifics, particularly in combination, and if we can find combinations that recapitulate the activity of CAR-T with off-the-shelf access, this could really be fundamentally paradigm changing.
You mentioned mantle cell, and I'm curious what your thoughts are. I feel like I was talking to an investigator who said that they thought that maybe mantle cell is actually more responsive to CAR T than diffuse large B cell. I don't know if you agreed. I didn't know that, but I'm curious. I know they haven't been. I guess there's not as much data with bispecifics in mantle cell, but what do we know about that?
So bispecifics and mantle cell are a story that is still being told. We do have now very nice data that have been generated looking at glofitamab in the treatment of mantle cell, and it's very active. And with more aggressive obinutuzumab pre-dosing, we can mitigate the cytokine release that has really been the barrier to more broad study of bispecifics in that disease state. Given that signal of activity and tolerability, we're actually working on the registrational trial comparing glofitamab to standard of care in the treatment of patients with relapsed mantle cell lymphoma. I do see a way forward in that disease state with such a strategy.
How about glofitamab plus pirtobrutinib?
Oh, you're a pirto fan. That's good. Pirtobrutinib is an excellent drug in both activity and tolerability, particularly in the post non-covalent BTK failure setting. I think that there's going to be a lot of interest in looking at various combinations, both in terms of older and newer BTKs. I think there's a lot of opportunities for combination studies after we establish single agent safety and activity.
Any thoughts about that comment that I heard about better efficacy of CAR T? I mean, indirectly, obviously, with mantle cell than diffuse large B cell. I don't know how many patients you've had go for CAR T.
Certainly CAR T is approved for the treatment of relapsed mantle cell lymphoma. Liso-cel is the approved agent. It has some tolerability issues that limit its broader usage in that disease. And we have a lot of other active agents. Certainly, response rates are excellent. I do not believe that there's an established curative potential of that treatment in mantle cell lymphoma, but it's a very relevant therapeutic option for young fit patients with relapsed mantle cell, particularly patients with P53 mutation or deletion that limits its responsiveness to some other therapeutic approaches.
What about bispecifics in CLL?
Not as much known yet. And I think that's partially because we recognize that circulating disease likely is a significant risk factor for toxicity with these treatments. We're going to start seeing some initial forays, and we're seeing some preliminary data there suggesting activity. I think that CLL is a space that has a lot of other active options and thus has a little bit of less unmet need. That combined with questions regarding tolerability in that disease space, I think will likely slow the development of bispecifics in CLL.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to Dr. Matisar, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Oncology Today.